From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office for the afternoon, so no update of the commodity markets. However, we will hear from the Farm Assets Conference that took place in December. This time around, the value of farmland with Michael Gunderson, the Chief Credit Officer at Farm Credit Illinois, and Bruce Sherrick, the Director of the TIA Center for Farmland Research and a member of the FarmDoc team here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
A quick reminder that the IFAS series, the Illinois Farm Economics Summits, will return in January of this year on the 9th, the 10th, and the 11th in Mount Vernon, East Peoria, and DeKalb. You can join the FarmDoc team for a half-day event. All the details are on our website at willag.org or at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Don't wait to register. Register today. Details are online again at willag.org or farmdocdaily.illinois.edu for the Illinois Farm Economic Series, the IFAS programs, on January the 9th, the 10th, and 11th in Mount Vernon, East Peoria, and DeKalb. Now, here's Michael Gunderson, the Chief Credit Officer from Farm Credit Illinois, from the Farm Assets Conference in December.
I do enjoy being on Twitter, although I don't tweet a whole lot myself. This is one of my very favorite all-time tweets. A young man, not a Purdue student. I was a Purdue faculty member for 7 years, not a Purdue student. He was at Nebraska. He said, AggieCom professor is trying to tell everyone you can't grow corn for less than $4.50 a bushel. That's why you're teaching and not farming. And the same can probably be said about your lender too, right? That's why we're lending and not farming. So just keep that in your mind as you're thinking about what I'm trying to talk to you about. I grew up on a dairy farm in Northwest Illinois. My brother's still a dairy farmer. I'm way too lazy to work that hard. I discovered my brother is too. He put in 4 Lely robots a few years ago, and he's milking some cows up there with them. So when I got to the University of Illinois as an undergrad, Nick and Joe weren't here, but Scott was. And as a first-generation college student, about halfway through my sophomore year, I learned you could get paid to go to grad school. So I went to Scott, and I was like, hey, Scott, I want to stay for another couple of years and get paid to do this. And he's like, no, Mike, you don't want to stay here. You want to go to Purdue. And I didn't know why he was so insistent, but it turns out Scott knew that the average IQ at both Illinois and Purdue went up when I went over there. So If we think about lending and agricultural land values, I've been saying for 3 years that land values shouldn't be going up anymore, and I've clearly been wrong, so just keep that in mind as I go through this presentation today. You know, from my perspective, I did well paying attention to Scott and folks at the University of Illinois. These are the things that affected farmland values when I was an undergrad, and they still affect farmland values today. So when I think about it, what's that future demand for agricultural commodities? I think sometimes folks think it's cliche that we need to grow enough food to feed a growing population, but that's true. I think that's why you should be optimistic about the future of farmland values, as we still have a growing population, growing wealth, changing diets, all of those things influence farmland values, and I think that's why they continue to tick up. You know, and then I think the profitability of a particular piece of farm ground, right? We see a pretty wide range of farmland values, even in the southern 60 counties that Farm Credit Illinois serves. So that productivity of that soil is going to determine how much we're willing to pay for it. The cash rent that it can generate might be another factor too. And then the last part is what you expect on a return on that investment, and you compare it to other investments. And so if you think it's a pretty low risk asset to be invested in, then you're probably going to settle for a pretty low return, and that means that you're going to be willing to pay a higher price today than you otherwise would be. So Bruce is going to talk a lot more about this and some trends that he's seen, but he wanted me to talk a little bit about how we think about it at Farm Credit Illinois. When I was at Purdue, I begged Scott and folks to let me come back to be a professor at Illinois, and they're like, no, stay at Purdue. I finally got to come back and be a part of a University of Illinois presentation, and that probably explains why Farm Credit Illinois had to pay for lunch today. So when we think about borrowing at Farm Credit Illinois, these are the things that we're really thinking about, particularly as we think about it from the the FLCA side, the farmland side, right? So we do a lot of operating loans, trying to help farm families succeed, but we do quite a bit of our business on the farmland side, and so paying attention to that and thinking about when we make those loans, what are the things that are important to us? So 5 C's of credit, for sure, the most important C of the 5 C's of credit is the character of that borrower. You know, when I talk to the credit team, we can talk about capacity and collateral and the other C's, and one C can be weak, but we can have an offsetting strength in a different C. If there's weakness in character, there is no offsetting strength to that. So we're looking for producers that have good management ability, that are doing things right, that are doing things that reflect well on our industry. So is that a profitable enterprise? And how is that going to affect their ability to repay the loan? That's ultimately what we're interested in. The other part is the strength of the farm balance sheet. So thinking about the capital structure of that business, how much are you using debt, how much are you using equity to finance the assets? And then finally, of course, the quality of the collateral. So thinking about that first slide and the factors that affect farmland values, how do we think about that at Farm Credit Illinois? We'll talk a little bit about that. For me, when I think about farm income, I pay a lot of attention to what USDA says, not because maybe they're the best or they're right, but they're the only ones willing to publicly share what they think about it. So, you know, I think when we look at net farm income over the past 20 years or so, even though net farm incomes are going to be down in 2023, there's a lot of good things still happening, right? We're still well above the 10-year average on net farm income, whether you measure it on an accrual basis or a cash basis. So 2023, a little bit tighter, but still pretty darn good relative to history. And then, man, if I could buy this graph and make it reality, I don't know how much I'd pay, but it'd be a large number. If you look at USDA's forecast out into the future for what net farm income is going to be, that's a pretty nice red bar, much larger than what it was over the two decades from 2002 to 2022. So I'm not sure what Kool-Aid they're drinking. Hopefully that comes to fruition, but I suspect there will be a lot more jagged up and downs in that red bar than what we see on that slide. Todd told me I had 20 minutes. Bruce said, make sure you only go 20 minutes. Man, I could talk about this slide for an hour. I love this slide. A friend of mine and a colleague of mine at Purdue created it originally, Chris Hurt, longtime ag economist, does a great job. He created this graph, and just the trend in the revenue generated by a piece of farmland over time is trending up. And everything on here is inflation adjusted, so that isn't happening because prices are going up. In fact, quite the opposite. On an inflation adjusted basis, the cost per bushel of corn has gone down the entire decade and 20 years that's on, or century and 20 years that's on this graph. So the upward trend in the value generated by an acre of farm ground is an entirely productivity based story, an entirely yield based story. My favorite part about this story is that large spike in 1973. It's the highest real farm revenue ever generated per acre. And if you were alive when that happened, that makes you old. And if you weren't, that makes you young, right? And I think part of the reason I love that spike is because it involves another Purdue PhD ag economist, Earl Butz, who negotiated with our mortal enemy to buy our wheat. We saw our commodity prices go through the roof and revenue just really go off the chart. Partly because I picked the axis of the chart, so it goes off the chart, but also because it is the record that we've ever seen, at least since 1906. And you can see this tweet, you can't see, but I can see this tweet is from March 16th, 2023, so already by March, Elon Musk had frittered away most of his value in Twitter and changed it to X, as you can see on the screen. But I found this to be a particularly great tweet as well. Maybe my second all-time favorite tweet, $620 per acre per year for 3 years, including the timber and sand, and winning bidder is 2.5 hours away by tractor. What could go wrong? God, I hate cash rent auctions. So I joined Farm Credit a year ago in November, so I'd only been on the job about 4 or 5 months. We have 14 regional offices in the 60 southern counties, and I sent an email to the regional managers of those 14 offices, and I said, what is going on out there? I know this is Compeer territory, which who knows what those guys up there are doing, but this is insanity. Well, one of our regional office managers sent me an email back and said, hey, Mike, that guy that won that auction, he's our borrower. So I've got to be a little bit more careful about the fun that I have with Twitter. So I do think that's a pretty crazy rent, but it certainly influences farmland values, right? If you can get $600 in rent per acre, man, you're willing to pay a lot for that acre probably. So some scenarios. How do we think about farmland values and what must be true for them to be worth $18,000, not $1,800? $1,800, that's pretty easy. $18,000 per acre, that's a little bit more challenging. So if you think about it from really the most simple way, the present value that you're willing to pay is based on what's the cash flow it's going to generate and what's the return you want on that asset. So if you think about cash rent as the cash flow and you're willing to settle for a pretty small rate of return on that investment, then at $350 cash rent per acre, you're looking at probably a 3% cap rate, assuming that cash rent is gonna grow at a constant 1% per year. Now, if you think about it from a production standpoint, right, you're not cash renting it, but rather you're operating it. How much of that revenue from that from that acre has to go back as return to farmland? So if this particular piece of farm ground is averaging 220 bushels per acre, and you're getting 482 per bushel, and you want about a third of that revenue, so whatever 220 times 482 is, a third of that is $350 per acre returned to the farmland ownership. So that's a way that you could think about $18,000 per acre. But like, I created this slide for a presentation this summer, and I feel like it's already dated because we see farmland prices in the 20,000s now this fall. So now I got to go back and figure out what's got to be true for that to be true. You know, and you can think about then, as we get to 20,000, how sensitive are farmland values to these various things? So across the bottom axis, how sensitive is it to bushels per acre? And then I drew different lines in terms of what do you think the corn price per bushel is gonna be, right? So at 20,000 per acre, you better hope that corn prices are gonna be well above 450 or that you can get 265 bushels an acre to be willing to pay 20,000. So $628 per acre rent. So that means that if you were willing to pay $18,000 for it, if you wanted to get a return on it, so for the $620 per acre, your cap rate can be as high as 4.4%. So you're expecting a much higher return on it because you're getting $620 rather than $350 per acre. Out here, it's telling you the last two columns is telling you what has to be true about these different things, right? So yield, price, and share, those three things together decide what's the return to farmland per acre. You can have 220 bushels and then a third of the share go back to farmland. Well, then you have to average 852 a bushel for that to be able to make sense on that cash rent. Or if you think prices are going to be 482, well, then you've got to grow 389 bushels per acre to get sort of that historical one-third of the revenue to go back to the farmland. So that's a crazy number for that cash rent. Bruce is going to talk a lot more about farmland values. He convinced TIA Cref to give him a whole bunch of money to do that, so we'll hear about that. So if we think about it from the credit perspective at Farm Credit Illinois, we're doing the 5 C's of credit. 5 C's of credit been true forever, talked about character and the importance of that. Capital, really thinking about what's the structure of that business in terms of debt and equity. Capacity, how well do they generate some income to be able to repay that loan. For me, collateral is a pretty unimportant C. And that's because at Farm Credit Illinois, our mission is to help farm families succeed. And the only time I care about your collateral and the quality of it is when you're not succeeding anymore. So it becomes a lot less important to me. But in the event that happens, then it does become the most important thing. So we do care about it. And then, of course, some conditions. We teach it at the university. Conditions is, what is the market environment this business is operating in? Because all of our businesses are operating in the same market, at farm credit, conditions means, what are we going to tell that farmer they got to do to stay in Farm Credit Illinois' good graces? So Dave Cole, retired faculty member from Virginia Tech University, really great guy, put together a list of, you know, one way to think about character and profitability. And the top of that list in terms of business IQ, I heard Matt Bennett say it this morning, and I know, or this afternoon, and I know he said it because he says it every time I see him in front of a farmer group, you have to know your cost of production. And it's not good enough just to be in your head. You need to write it down. What's that? Or build a spreadsheet, actually, is even better, right? Know that cost of production. Know that cost of production by enterprise. Know what your goals are as your business and your family, right? I think about our field staff out working with farmers, trying to help them succeed. How can we possibly know if we're helping you succeed if you haven't written down your goals and helped us understand what those are and how we can play a role in that success? So this is a way that you can think about the character of that operator, and then think about their profits, right? So brother's a dairy farmer. He likes to complain all the time. When milk prices get high, he tells me that feed prices are too high. So it's never good enough for him. But I just tell him, I'm like, are you a middle-sized farm or a large farm? Because over half of your peers are making 20% profit margins, right? If you're a middle-sized or large farmer, over half of your peers are making profit margins of 20%. So if you're telling me that your profit margins suck, you're telling me that you suck as a dairy farmer. He doesn't really care for that too much. So now that we both have kids, though, when he has a good profitable year, I just remind him, man, you had a really great year. Jarvis wants a PlayStation 5 this year. That'd be good. So, okay. So character and capacity, that's a big part of what we're thinking about as we think about that loan. Do they have the ability to repay the interest? And just know that credit has nothing to do with setting interest rates. That's all marketing and Rod Stahl. So if you feel like your interest rates are too high, talk to Rod, not to me. So when we think about our lending, when we think about our standards, we do have our core standards. So we said on that balance sheet, assets equals debt plus equity. We want owner's equity to be greater than 50%. We are committed to helping farm families succeed, and in particular, helping the next generation of farm families succeed. So we have a great Fresh Roots program where we, as a credit team, understand they're not going to be in the same position financially or managerially as their peers who have been farming for much longer. So we have some relaxed standards for our Fresh Roots borrowers, and we only look for them to have owner's equity of 20%. When we think about liquidity, 15% of working capital to gross income is our core standard. On the Fresh Roots side, we look at a current ratio 1-to-1. We talked about capacity being profitability. Can you repay your loan? What's the margin of you being able to do that? And then finally, loan to value. And we'll talk about how we think about that value here in a second. So liquidity, I think about, go back, not forward. Liquidity, I think about our working capital, right? So your current assets minus your current liabilities. We recently made a tweak to our credit decisioning model where we asked our field staff to ask their borrower what their working capital is. And they said, well, they don't know. I was like, well, if they don't know their cost of production and they don't know their working capital, we've got a lot of problems that we need to talk about, right? Managing that business, thinking about the structure of that balance sheet and how we're managing inventories, how we're managing inputs to be successful. We can also think about it from working capital to gross farm revenue. That's our standard on the traditional side. And then for our Fresh Roots bar, we think about current ratio, so current assets divided by current liabilities. And just that top part of the income statement, what are the things, what are the inventories that we have, what's the cash we have on hand, what are the prepaid expenses that we've prepaid at the end of the year to manage our taxes? How are those things influencing our success? And do we have enough of those to be able to meet our liabilities that are also due this year? So think about that liquidity position making sure that we have a strong top part of the balance sheet. It is the case, you know, I poke fun at my brother, but it is the case that every year around April 15th, he'll call me and remind me that I'm the one with a PhD in economics and he's just the dumb dairy farmer, but he didn't pay any taxes. And I paid a bunch. And you farmers are very good at managing that tax liability. And part of that is paying attention to those current assets and liquidity. So then we think about, as we move away from sort of the short run liquidity, we move to a longer term solvency. How are you managing that left-hand side of the balance sheet by using your liabilities and owner's equity to acquire assets? So you can use debt to assets, you can use owner's equity percentage, you can use assets to equity, you can use equity to debt, you can use whatever combination of those three you want. They all tell you the exact same thing, and that is, how do you mix debt and equity to acquire your assets? For us, and for the USDA, actually USDA defines a farming operation whose debt to asset ratio is above 50% as financially stressed, right? So when we think about this, from a helping farm families succeed perspective, if a farmer's in a hole, you don't help them by giving them a shovel, right? And I think if a farmer's in a hole, we're not helping that farm family succeed by giving them more debt if they think that's going to dig them out, right? We've got to work with them, think about how do we get that capital structure in a place that allows them to be successful and grow that business in the future. And I think that's the part here that's most important to us is, how do we manage growth in a capital-intensive industry? When it's costing you $20,000 an acre to buy a piece of farm ground, that by definition is a capital-intensive industry. And what are the things that we can do to help you grow into that rather than getting out over your skis, right? So sometimes, Mike Bolgi was a colleague of mine at Purdue, and one of his favorite saying was, maybe you need to get better before you get bigger. And I think a lot of times as we're working with farmers, we think about that as well at Farm Credit Illinois. The last part to talk about is the quality of the collateral and how we think about that. I'll try to keep it as short as I can on the commercial, but we're a no-fees lender. And part of that is we don't charge an appraisal fee because we have an internal appraisal department that's looking at farmland values all the time. They know what's going on out in the marketplace. They're paying attention to sales. And so we've got some benchmark farms scattered around our territory, our southern 60 counties, that annually we take a look at and think about, how did farmland values surrounding those benchmark farms change, and how does that change what we think those benchmark farms are worth? And this is, Kent Reed put this together. He's our chief appraiser, taking a look across different soil qualities in our territory. So A soil quality farms, B soil quality farms, C quality in the north part of our territory, not in the northern part of Illinois, but in the northern part of our territory, and sea quality soils in the southern part. And you can see they've been ticking up pretty well, and they continued to tick up into 2023. So across those 15 benchmarks, 15 of them were up, ranging from about 1% increase in value up to 31% increase in value. So a pretty substantial increase in the benchmark. And overall, an 8.1% increase in farmland values. And then he also pays attention to cash rents and what's happening out there. We saw cash rents tick up again in 2023. So if you're not owning the land, that might be an additional cost. So then we take that appraised value, we take what Kent and team do, and we say we're gonna lend up to as much as 70% of that appraised value. So we're thinking about value around what that farmland market is being affected by the supply and demand factors of a particular piece of ground. So I am on Twitter. If you want to follow me, that's great, but don't expect a whole lot of tweets. But you can always send me an email, give me a call. If you come to Mahomet and you're driving on Interstate 74, I sit right under that logo on the corner of our building. So come on upstairs. Be glad to have a conversation.
That was Mike Gunderson. He is the Chief Credit Officer at Farm Credit Illinois. He spoke at the Farm Assets Conference. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. The other person that was up to discuss land values during the Farm Assets Conference was the director of the TIA Center for Farmland Research. His name is Bruce Sherrick. He's an agricultural economist and part of the FarmDoc team.
So thanks, Todd. Can everyone hear okay? Todd said, we're saving the best for last, and I thought that was absolutely such a great compliment. He says, no, the last thing we're going to do is have a beer at Houlihan's, so be fast. So we're going to go through a very, very graphics-rich presentation and a flyby across the country and look at land values. As Todd mentioned, TIA Center for Farmland Research, Advancing Farmland Markets Through Research and Information. It's a great research facility we developed at the University of Illinois for the last almost 20 years now. And we have some amazing data sets and some amazing connections out in the real world, so hopefully you'll like this little flyby. So first of all, and I know the numbers are small, I'll kind of point to the color and tell you what they mean. And this is a USDA-based survey. Illinois, for example, says 9580. You can essentially multiply these by two, because this is for all farmland. It includes things that are not commercially viable, like my backyard is almost a farm. We'll talk about the kind of problems we have and the benefits we have of having a long-term USDA data set. But look at the California number, look at the Illinois number, and think about how this relates to the amount of productivity you get per acre of soil. And that's kind of the big explanation. What does work, though, is to say the percentage price changes are very consistent, whether we're talking about 10,000 becoming 12,000, 20% up, or 20,000 becoming 24,000. They're very, very reliable data, and they do calibrate through time. So look at this number, look at this set of numbers and just be amazed. The middle of the country really did catch up. I think of the Corn Belt as essentially the head of the slinky, and you pull it because something happened. We had an invasion of Ukraine, or we had a reduction of interest rates during the pandemic, or MFP payments, or transition payments, or COVID. All of those things kind of hit the Corn Belt first, and we had a 20-30% increase in value, and then the rest of the country kind of is the end of the slinky and kind of caught back up. The middle of the country, this is a real effect. You go down through the lower parts of what we call the Northern Plains, a little oddly named, and we had some of the most massive increases in value we've ever seen. Now, when I walked in today, Ken, among others, you know, I'd love to chat with people, and he said something like, farmland values are really, really high. Can we keep them here? So I want to know my audience a little bit. First of all, anybody who owns farmland, hold your hand up. Okay? Anybody who would like to own more farmland, hold your hand up. About the same crowd, right? Anybody who thinks farmland's too expensive to buy more farmland, hold your hand up. Keep it up if you want to sell me your farm at that price. Okay, so there's something really rational about markets. We don't really have anything that is sort of out of line, or markets correct themselves. So we're going to talk about that and kind of go through. If we go three-year picture, this one's really fun. 65% increase in certain parts of the country over the last 3 years. 65%. Surely that's not sustainable. Surely that's a bubble. Surely that's an anomaly. For the last 35 years of my career, I've heard people talk about the farmland bubble. Okay? Hasn't really popped yet. 81 through 86, we kind of had a lender-induced crisis that was very farm-specific. For the rest of that period of time, it's been an economy-wide farmland market, not just a farm sector market. So we'll kind of walk around the country a little bit more and talk about some things. Cropland returns, this is just absolutely fundamentally important to understand. Owning farmland has been better for you than investing in the S&P 500, no matter what 10-year period you pick. Farmland has returned more than investing in equities. High alpha, all the academic studies will show this, low beta, very low, high correlation with inflation, it's terrific. The problem is you can't buy it. Okay, so it's one thing to say the performance has been better, but it's a really complicated market to deal with. High transaction costs, hard to get into, have to hold it a long time to get those realizations. Has a very different profile of income to appreciation than equities. So even though this is true, this is not the full story yet. It's a really, really critical asset to get right. And we'll talk about what's different going forward as we get to the end. But I think the forces that have created this are different now than they have been, but I think they extend into the future just as reliably as they had in the past. And Mike said something very important. We're going to feed a growing world. Malthus will always be wrong. we have to have massive yield increases. We have to figure out where we're going to grow things. We have to decide whether or not we're going to put the calories that we grow in the land into a pig's stomach, your SUV's gas tank, into something else. But we're going to eventually feed people because prices equilibrate. So we're going to go through those arguments as well. If you look at why some of the states are really critical to this conversation, and later on we create some weighted indices based on the value of the production, look at California. California is like the world's fourth largest economy if it were a country. It's giant, it's massive, two massive valleys for growing a lot of the fruits and vegetables and tree nuts that we have in the country, a lot of dairy, some of the forage, but there's water issues there. Pacific Northwest, massive flexibility to grow things in the PNW. Different issues there. The upper Midwest. So as we go around the country, we're really going to decide that there are about 12 different farmland markets. It's not just the farmland market. These are really, really fundamentally different. It's where you go. Texas is just large. If you put it on a per acre basis, it's not nearly as impressive. But what you'll see near the end is where we're going to locate some things in the future, not where we have things now. And Texas turns out to be a relative winner. Okay, balance sheet of ag sector. Sometimes I do this in a bunch of numbers, but I just want to point out that it's growing massively. It's over $4 trillion, with a T, trillion. Now, I know we've become, in this country, numb to the difference between million, billion, trillion, things like that. We can, you know, spend a few billion here, a few trillion there, and we don't think it's a different number. And I was reminded again in earlier conversations about this, something I use in an undergrad class. You ask students, how long is a million seconds? And most of you have heard this by now because it's kind of a good, you know, cocktail party trick. How long is a million seconds? Well, you shouldn't really be able to do that math in your head, but call it 12 days. How long is a billion seconds? Again, you can't really do that math in your head, but it's about 31 years. How long is a trillion seconds? Now you should be able to do that because it's 31,000 years. So if you have a farm program that spent $1 million, that's a dollar a second for 12 days. $1 billion, that's a dollar a second for 31 years. A trillion, that's a dollar a second for 31,000 years. So during the pandemic, we spent 272,000 years of a dollar per second of our future paying for something that's now showing up in inflation. Okay? These are real, like, fun numbers to talk through, but let's talk about it with respect to farmland. Well, how many farms are there? They're getting bigger. And this is a fun graph, again, under 2 million, and each of those little, like, bumps up are when Congress said, gosh, there's not enough farmers. We need to make the definition of a farm smaller so we can count more of them. We need some farm bill support. But you get down to the end, and it's about 2 million, and about half of those are commercial scale. So call it 1 million so we can do the math in our head. 340 million people in the U.S., so every farm has to supply the caloric requirements for about 340 people. Wait, except we export a lot too, so now if you do the math, it turns out to be a little over 400 people. That's kind of impressive, right? So think about the scale of operation that has to feed 400 people and supply all their other calorie requirements for that. Now, we're importing more agricultural products because we like blueberries all 12 months of the year, and we like strawberries all 12 months of the year, and so on. So the net trade balance has actually, on dollar basis, turned back for the first time in the last couple years that we're a net importer of agricultural products. This is a long-term recipe for disaster if we don't fix our export markets. We can't get into trade wars and trade spats and onshore everything unless you want your iPhone to cost $32,000. Let's make it where labor's cheaper. So those kind of issues going forward, but structurally, we're headed this direction for a long time. Farms are gonna get bigger. There's gonna be less of them. Coping with that and understanding the reality of who actually owns farms compared to who actually farms is a really important consideration. This is the summary, won't make you read it, except to say a few things. The value of Apple as a company is a little over $3 trillion, bounces around that. Farmland in the U.S. is only $4 trillion. So which one is wrong? Would you rather own all the farmland in the U.S. or all the Apple stock in the U.S.? I'd take the tradable farmland. There's almost no debt, 13%, almost no debt. That's a ridiculously low amount of debt.
Borrow more.
Borrow more. Absolutely. That's like the Chick-fil-A, eat more. Yeah. So very low aggregate debt on the long-term side. So increases in interest rates didn't affect much like they did in commercial real estate. I have some farmland and I have a bunch of fixed rate debt on it. And then when interest rates went up, I'm like, yes, my debt just got cheaper. My relative value of my debt just became more valuable. That was a great thing for me. People are like, aren't you worried about interest rates going up? No, not. So operating notes became much more expensive, of course. But again, doing the math carefully, it's a few bushels per acre difference when interest rates went from 4% to 7% on an operating note. It's really complicated to retail the asset class. Most of you have seen an advertisement from AcreTrader or Farm Together or Magma or Steward, or there's seven of these fractional farmland ownership programs now. It's still hard to do. The fees are too expensive. It's a complicated, real assets are hard to trade. It's big titling costs, big, just hard to trade. So I don't think you can look at this again and say, just because of these summary statistics, I want to move into or out of farmland. It's been maybe 10 years ago, I had an article that was, I think, reasonably well received called What's the Ticker Symbol for Farmland? And it literally came about because some fund that had been in some set of presentations had decided they needed more exposure to farmland as an asset class. And one of the junior analysts called me and said, hey, my boss has me looking for this. Like, what's the ticker symbol for farmland? I'm like, ha, this is why you will never own a farm. So low correlation with financials, high alpha, high correlation with inflation, and most importantly, it doesn't turn over. So one of the explanations for the high relative prices is there's been almost no transactions in the last year and a half. The general long-term run rate in Illinois at arm's length, meaning not between related parties, not including non-familial but related party relationships, about 1.5%. And so as that number goes down to 1%, it feels like a 33% reduction in volume of sales. That feels like a thin market. So you get these effects like we had in Missouri a few weeks ago, the $34,800 an acre sale. Can you come up with those numbers? You had to grow, what, 600 bushels of corn to make that make sense? But there are other features in owning farmland that will explain that. We'll go through some of that. Oh, shoot, this is an accident. I have a 3-year-old grandson, and he likes to scribble pictures and give them to me. Sorry, that. No, wait, this is the Fed. I was wrong. This is the Fed. If you look at that top left picture, it looks like a 3-year-old scribbled. This is the management of the Fed's discount rate through time. And the only thing I want to impress upon you is that it doesn't respond to economic conditions. It responds to political, social, or emergency situations. So we shouldn't think about the interest rate market as also being driven by what we historically were taught it was driven by: aggregate demand, aggregate supply, ability to manage inflation. And when the Fed started its uptick, I don't know if the laser works on this or not, kind of in December of 2021, what they discovered is that the interest rate markets are no longer connected to the wage markets in the way they used to be. So it was hard. They're pulling, instead of on a string, they were again pulling on a slinky. So we ended up with this long collection of interest rate actions that are just now kind of coming into the market. Thinking about how that's going to work forward is really critical. So again, I make fun of that top left graph because I went through grad school back when people were more rational. And you would think about things like rules rather than discretion, or not using the Fed and the Treasury as a combined vehicle to advance some political agenda, but instead to sort of manage it independently. The top right picture is the Fed's balance sheet. And just what's important about that is the scale's never before been anything like this. If you go all the way back to the 30s, that line would have been pencil thin and constant. Got to the 50s, moved up a little. Got to the 70s, moved up a little. I should have done this like almost with shadow puppets so I could have joined up with that. And then we got to 2008 and we performed an experiment to try to save the economy where we said the Fed will buy from banks in particular low quality assets so that it could shrink the balance sheet, not be underwater on their capital, and continue operating. And it turned out to work. Assets performed better than we expected. And folks, we got hooked on that drug. And so we said, oh gosh, it doesn't matter anymore. We don't have to price debt anymore. We can just print it and put it on the Fed's balance sheet essentially. The problem is now that we're today shrinking the Fed's balance sheet by a couple trillion, is the same as increasing interest rates by 0.5%. So it's not just the Fed's action. It's now monetarily, we also have another effect in the economy that's causing inflation or offsetting inflation that we can't see in that top left graph. The bottom graph is the most scary one of all. So the blue line, essentially, think about inflation versus the 10-year rate. And the 10-year rate is the red. And so we think of that as the index for all other interest rates. And then lending rates or borrowing rates are just some index above that. It's kind of how the economy has worked. And we got to this period of time from 2020, March 9th in particular, 2020, when inflation was essentially a result of monetizing the money that had been printed. It's okay, we can do those experiments. We had a pandemic, we had to do something. Not commenting on if that was good or bad, I'm just saying this is the effect. And we had a 10-year treasury rate that is just now back above. So much like you were saying, land values can't go up any further for 3 years, I was saying that can't happen for very long for the last 3 years. And I'm finally right, it couldn't happen forever. Yeah, but we're now back into an era where we can think about the valuation of farmland based on the principles that we care about. Here's one of them. This is an amazing graph, absolutely astounding. If you look at the top 32 states in the US, combined by value of agricultural production, and compare it to the inflation rate, what return you would have gotten from holding that diversified agricultural portfolio to holding treasury inflation protected securities only, what you find out is that the farmland hedge over inflation is an amazing thing. And in the last 3 years, we essentially got an anticipatory version of that increase in farmland values. Inflation was going to be higher, farmland values went up. Now, why is that the case? Definition of inflation is the nominal change in widely consumed commodities. What are most widely consumed commodities produced by? Farmland creates widely. So it is, in fact, the non-depreciable store of production value against the nominal value of everything. Whether we put that into, again, an energy application or a food application, doesn't really matter. And if you look at it by decade, again, when interest rates were nominally higher, 70s and 80s, the spread is nominally bigger as well. When interest rates were lower, then again, the spread is a bit lower as well. But in the last 3 years, look at what a wonderful inflation hedge it's been. So pension funds, folks with long duration liability problems really find agriculture to be a really attractive asset class. Really quite amazing. Real quickly, I'm going to fly by the country. This chart, again, I can make these available if anybody cares. I want to point out that the top is USDA-based, the bottom is NCREIF-based, National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries, and that's the professionally managed farmland. That's like if you're a real farmer. The top includes people like me, who has a lot of tomatoes in my backyard. So the regions of the country, as you go further in time, long-term holding periods, stabilize a bit. Then the bottom three are what's really critical. Return to farmland, annual cropland, 10%. Permanent cropland, a little over 10%. 20 years at 13.9. These are astounding numbers for a 20-year hold period, 14% a year. You can actually get rich earning 14% a year. So these are numbers that come from intentionally managed for gain farmland, which I think is the best version to look at. Farm I grew up on, small enough that it wasn't going to support lots of families. We wouldn't have achieved these numbers, but part of our consumption of living on a farm was raising kids on a farm. The bottom three are really commercial farms. Now let's fly by the country at 30,000 feet. California, and a way to think about this chart, each of them I'm going to go through, has a picture of where in the country, some graph that tells you either values or returns, and despite all the problems in California, price per acre is going up at an increasing rate. Getting water on the right acres make those acres really valuable. Tree nuts, a disaster right now. Almonds, a real problem. Pistachios, I thought they used to only be red and happen at Christmas time. Who knew they were a nut? So, tough crowd, you guys can laugh a little. wine grape.
It goes better in California.
Yeah, true. Wine grapes, still sorting it out because we've discovered that Napa and Sonoma, if you take the labels off, aren't the only places that can grow great wines. And SGMA, Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, is beginning to affect things. So eventually we're going to have to grow tomatoes somewhere other than out on flat grounds east of Fresno. It's going to happen. Still going up in price. And then the bottom is just different periods of time that I think are interesting. And after tax, you can look at the annualized rates of return. Last couple years, around 9%. Long-term on the left, short-term on the right, between 8 and 9%. After all expenses, pretty good. Pacific Northwest, astounding region, 11%, 12%. So many things you can grow. Irrigated wheat in the area around Walla Walla, 175 bushel an acre, is not out of range. Think about that for wheat. You can grow potatoes one year, followed by carrots the next year, and corn, and then soybeans, and then grass seed. And so the movability of acres across crops is really quite astounding. And some of the best wine is now coming out of Walla Walla and some of the areas of the Pacific Northwest. You'll see a real emphasis on wine. Apples have been a disaster, partly because of the varietal issues. We all like apples that end with the word crisp now for some reason, and I don't know sure why. But that's also important because you can get onto water and get access to export markets pretty quickly from the Pacific Northwest. Southern Plains, 10% rate of return, hold that. Energy farming is going to become a big deal. And cattle farming and uses of feedstocks, places where after you grew the grain, you had to do something with it. A large number of chickens and a large number of the cattle come from this part of the country, also in Georgia. Northern Plains, the surprise, if you happen to have farmland in North and South Dakota, you got here in your private jet today. If you didn't, you probably still did okay, but the things Emerson talked about and others, the yield increases due to genetics alone, nothing short of miraculous. And I have an interest in a farm in South Dakota, and we probably get 15 to 20 days more frost-free period of time now than they did 25 years ago. So you just have this, again, catch-up from the fact that we didn't used to grow as much corn as we do now in North and South Dakota. We didn't used to grow it as well. We didn't have as many demands for it. And the upper Midwest location of access to things with decent basis is highly mixed. You may have to go a long way to get to a use for feed. You may not have to go very far, though, to get to an ethanol plant. And so that changing demand for what we grow has been really amazing. But look at the rate of gain in the last few years. It's just amazing. Lake States, again, since I grew up in Ohio, I'm not allowed to, at this point in the year, recognize the existence of that state that begins with an M. But the other states have done really, really well here. And that Lake State region, despite the loss of dairy, despite the loss of some other things that happened, has done really remarkably in terms of a rate of return. Again, these numbers are just astounding to people who didn't grow up in ag. People who grew up in ag are kind of like, yeah, it makes sense. And so it also makes sense why land values are what they are today. Last one that we'll focus a tiny bit more on, Corn Belt. And for fun on this one, I included rental rates so we could implicitly calculate cap rates and also the CPI and the CMT at the bottom, or the inflation rate, CPI, and the 10-year CMT. So you can think about the gain over inflation that you had in any particular period. And again, I apologize, the graphs are a little dense here. If you want them, just send me an email, I'll send them to you. But this is, again, kind of astounding. We're sitting on, you know, the most productive part of the country, frankly, in terms of growing corn and soybeans here to Iowa, and the rates of return have reflected that. Last 2 years, almost 13%. That's after all expenses. These are real numbers. That's a real rate of gain. So if you're getting that much on an asset, you expect the asset value to go up to drive the adjusted returns back down to a level that's commensurate with the risk and the other assets that you might be investing in. So that is actually the punchline. Finally, this conversation you've undoubtedly heard about the last 5 years, last 7 years, BlackRock once said something about we're going to include sustainability considerations in everything we do going from here forward. Changed the investing world, changed the way investment bankers thought about things. 90-some percent of the S&P 500 companies had sustainability goals, and about two-thirds of them included explicit carbon goals. A couple of years ago, the Net Zero America Project was published, and about two-thirds of the S&P 500 now have net zero goals as well. The problem is, you can't get there. If you take all the company's promises to get to net zero, and divide it even to the next year's increment required to get to their long-term target, you can't get there. There's not enough tradable carbon credit. There's not a place to offset. And just like flying an airplane, you don't offset that by flying it with batteries that were charged with nuclear. There are certain things you can't do yet. And you can't capture enough carbon anywhere to buy it from somebody to create a net zero impact. So we have to think about what's going to adjust. And what's going to adjust, at least in this country, we've made a pretty strong commitment that's got the flywheel, and it's a heavy flywheel, spinning pretty fast on conversion to wind, solar, and some other things that are kind of derived from hydrolytic divisions of things and hydrogen. There's things we can do, but the question then is, where will we do that? Well, it turns out you can't go generate electricity in the deserts because the transmission lines and the cost to get it to people is greater than the value of what you produce. It also turns out, with my apologies to those of you who may have it, you should never put a solar panel on a house. It's right in angle only twice per year, even if you're lucky, and the switching cost is ridiculous. But we do that because we have states that want to subsidize that, so they'll pay for your switching costs, pay for it. Individually, it can make sense, but it costs the whole system more when more of that happens. So where should it happen is a great question. Should happen where you're close enough to a population, you have high enough quality solar, closer to the equator, or you have constant enough winds, close enough to the California fault line, which extends across the middle of Illinois. And so if you put them together and said, where should you put this investment to get to net zero, these are the areas shaded darker where you'll get that additional investment. Where do you see wind towers now? Kind of already makes sense. Wind towers went in where they made the most sense first. Where are we going to see solar? Well, it turns out this argument like, well, don't put it over top of good farmland. Well, of course you will. If somebody's going to pay you $3,000 an acre instead of $300 an acre, you should put it over farmland. It's going to make the other farmland worth even more. So these questions have to be sorted out with a much more comprehensive view of what we're actually trying to get to. And if you put them together, oh, carbon storage too is a fun one. I have two separate pictures from this. You can either think about putting more carbon in the soil in terms of organic matter, but there's a limit. Once you get above, you know, 8 or 9%, the soil just aspirates it differently. And Emerson's stuff was really good. Just the soil availability of carbon, it's a complicated thing. You can't just say, carbon, stay in the soil. It's you can put a lot of roots in the soil and you can leave mass in the soil, but the natural process of nitrification is too complex to really count on. But we kind of know where we can get more in the soil. We also know where it's going to be windy and kind of where the sun's going to shine. Turns out we worked that out for some time. And if you put it all together, whoops, how do we back up? Put it all together, it ends up on those areas. And that's why Texas turns out to be a relative winner. It's both close to the equator, you can get a lot of good solar, land values aren't as expensive, close to a lot of people. Turns out that's a good place to put a lot of the greening of the energy complex. So, punchlines. We talked about it earlier, I'll talk about it again. The farm bill is becoming a different thing than it used to be. It's now becoming a bit of a proxy debate. We're going to keep crop insurance, we're going to keep conservation titles, but we're going to increasingly use it to green up the energy complex. That's kind of where the farm bill conversations are going. Trade, we have to get this right. We can't keep having ping pong balls back and forth about, well, we don't like this country, so we want to put a tariff on them. Well, that hurts both countries. It's not just, that's just a ridiculous response. Again, I'm an economist, I don't have to get votes. So I get why you do it, but it doesn't help get to the long term. And the third bullet point here is kind of cool to think about. When we went through the pandemic and we didn't go out to eat as much, we started spending more in the grocery stores. That's good, but a small fraction of the amount of money you spend in a grocery store gets back to the farm, but it's still more. And it turns out that when we can go back to grocery, we can go back to restaurants, we still like to buy more good stuff in grocery stores. So the inflation effect in asset things that came from farmland is a little bit more sticky than other parts of the economy. This is good for agriculture. And mostly, though, people want to know attributes about their food that they didn't used to care about. We used to grow number two yellow corn. Now if you've seen the episode of Portlandia, we want to know if our chickens were happy, right? So we've gone to the point where we're not just buying corn, we're buying a particular variety of kale for our smoothie on the way to the work because we can. So that attribute-specific payment for things we grow has increased the share of dollars we spend to agriculture. Okay, so you want a crystal ball? I'll tell you what I think is going to happen. farmland's going to be worth more in the future. Okay? That was a really risky prediction, right? I think the yield curve and interest rates have to normalize. Eventually, we're going to get an upward sloping yield curve again, and we're kind of moving in that direction. I think incomes are going to normalize, but they're going to normalize around the fact that we're going to have Nigeria alone will have more people than the U.S. in 15 or 20 years. We're going to have to feed a population that's richer, further away from where we grow it now, and willing to have higher quality diets. We're going to have to feed more of our food to animals first to feed people the meat they want to eat. Inflation also going to normalize, but not going to go back down to zero. It's Mike, admit it, it's hard to teach time value of money to students who've never had positive interest rates in their own like adult experience. But we're not going to get rid of climate in our debate about agriculture either. We're going to start using agriculture as the solution instead of the whipping boy. So all these things, interest rates, income and inflation, strong recent appreciation, Farm Bill will eventually pass, and it's going to have more money in it every time. Scott, who might still be in the room, is famous for pointing out there's nothing as permanent as a temporary government program. Farm Bill is not going to shrink. We're going to get more and more crop insurance and other protections. And finally, the attractive financial investment characteristics of farmland remain. So I ask you, first of all, who wants to sell me your farm? And nobody, you know, y'all sat on your hands real quickly. Who thinks their assets are too expensive? But what asset would you rather own? As an asset in production and in a lifestyle, that's also still a really important feature of supporting farmland values going forward.
That's Bruce Sherrick. He's the director of the TIA Center for Farmland Research in the College of ACES on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, a member of the FarmDoc team, an agricultural economist, and joined us during the Farm Assets Conference, along with Mike Gunderson, who you also heard today on the Closing Market Report, which comes to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. You can hear Bruce again if you'd like during the Illinois Farm Economic Summit. See him in person, by the way. But you need to get yourself signed up. Don't wait. Do that right now today. Again, you can do that at willag.org or on the FarmDoc Daily website at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.